Hello and welcome to the One Liners One and Only podcast from the Edinburgh International Film Festival 2011. That's because this year the film festival has been disappointing, to say the least. There's a considerably reduced amount of films available, most of which have been available at other film festivals for many months, possibly even a year. And there's just not quite the buzz around it this year, wouldn't you say, Scott?
Yeah, certainly not the same level of excitement. For me, at least part of the fun of this is the feeling of seeing a film that very few other people have discovered, and that's kind of lessened when you can download almost all of them on DVD and Blu-ray from other parts of the world. Also, I was questioning the festival's purpose. I mean, okay, it's great for audiences, but I'm sure a lot of it is actually to try and get distribution deals for these films in front of other buyers, and if they're actually already old films that are old news, I wonder how many of them are going to get picked up for UK distribution or other such territories worldwide.
Two other significant things too were that, looking at the brochure, you've got to wonder why many people would be interested in coming to it, because I think I'm probably not being ridiculously over top suggesting that perhaps even a third of the films are old films.
And we mean old as in the, you know, picked by as retrospectives of things from the 60s and 70s rather than just, you know, a couple of years back, which has always been a feature of the festival, but it was a kind of minor one.
Yeah, it seems very significant now.
Yeah.
It's quite clearly that they're in there to bulk up the numbers.
Yeah, I mean, the tagline for the festival was All That Heavens Allows. I think it might actually have been whatever films we could find.
Yes.
Might be a more appropriate one for them.
Rather disappointingly. And the festival also dropped this year the long-running and quite prestigious, I believe, Michael Powell Award for Best British Film, which has not gone down well at all with the British film industry, such as it is.
Yeah, puzzling decision, but...
Yes, and in its June slot, it's been there for 4 years now since it moved from its traditional August slot, its audience continues to dwindle. So it's not got the most hopeful outlook at the moment, and I certainly hope it picks up, but things are not looking good for the IFF right now.
Well, we can but hope for a recovery. I mean, I'll say one thing about it, but it's probably just because I've been more discerning this year. I've probably seen a higher average quality of film throughout these, but we'll get onto that as we go, I imagine.
Scott and I have indeed seen some films from the festival this year, and we're about to spill the beans to you, dear listener. So, Scott, fire away.
First up is Phase 7. It is essentially one of these kind of small subgenre of quarantine-based horrors, but with has a little bit of a more of a tongue-in-cheek to it. There is a virus epidemic outside, and the authorities suspect that there is a victim inside a young married couple, Coco Daniel Hendler and his heavily pregnant wife, Pippi, played by Jasmine Stewart. They are caught somewhat unawares by this. The government seal off their building along with a few other residents in there and are told to just hold up in there while they're under quarantine. The rest of the world goes a bit mad. Basically, it's almost a world-ending pandemic going on outside. As they're sealed inside a building with their neighbours, they tend to turn on each other as paranoia goes through the roof as supplies start dwindling. And it ends up becoming a cat-and-mouse hunt through the apartment block as they turn on each other towards the end. It's sounds a little bit grim, don't remember saying that, but it's actually handled with a fairly light touch. It's more in the kind of horror slash thriller genres than any other one I can think of pigeonholing in it, but it's not really putting too much emphasis on that. It's fairly lightly handled. Daniel Hendler himself is a pretty likeable character, and it's, if nothing else, for his amusing facial hair that he grows as the quarantine goes on for longer. It's a likeable relationship between him and his wife, and it remains pretty likeable throughout. There's solid supporting cast, which provides some pretty interesting moments. Fair amount of humour. Quite gory, which is in no way scary, but it's kind of fun. But without going completely over the top, it's not all about gore. There is some kind of interesting characters in there. There's some good moments of comedy stemming from the characterisation that they have. I enjoyed this quite a lot. It's not a genre I'm noted for liking. This kind of thing can be quite dreadful, and most of the obvious things you compare it to probably aren't very good, certainly recently. You know, its closest comparison, I suppose, lately is Wreck, and there's a few other ones that are kind of like that, and they've been relatively popular, but I've not liked them. But this, I do like. It's quite funny. I quite enjoyed that.
Think it any similarity to At Your Door, which is slightly quarantine-based and certainly would be a bit better than things like Wreck?
not an awful lot, if I actually come to think of it. Other than the basic setup of it, there is a quarantine and they have to stay in a flat. But if memory serves, At Your Door was only, there was only those two actors. It was just those two and their kind of relationship falling apart as that goes on. And there wasn't too much else to it, whereas this is a bit more, okay, there's conflict between neighbouring apartments and they can come and go between each other's more or less as they please, and there's the kind of crazy neighbour upstairs that's all into his conspiracy theories and starts arming himself and his Coco as a, seeing him as an ally against the others who are kind of allying against him. So it's a bit more, I suppose, like The Thing than At Your Door, which is no bad thing to be compared against them, I suppose.
Indeed.
Crashing onwards, we have Bobby Fischer Against the World. Drew?
Yes, this is a documentary. It uses a mixture of interviews and archive footage and paints a portrait of the life of legendary chess player Bobby Fischer from the time of him being a prodigiously talented teenager through his Cold War extension chess match against the Soviet world champion Boris Spassky and his subsequent troubles, including exile from the United States up until his death a few years ago. Though he was clearly spectacularly talented at chess, though apparently not at pretty much anything else, Bobby Fischer was a particularly unlikable person. Though he was clearly troubled, outside pressure certainly can't have helped. Though you have to make up your own mind if his mental health and the nature of his life mitigate the more unsavory aspects of his character. But Bobby Fischer Against the World should give you ample opportunity to do that, because whatever the case, Liz Garbus has done a fine job in this documentary of humanising Fischer and making the viewer sympathetic, I think would be fair to say, to this incredibly complex and deeply troubled man, and it's certainly a recommended viewing. And important note, an interest in chess is not required.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's an interesting film just because Bobby Fischer himself is such an interesting cat. It's good, I think, that we'd watched Senna so recently, because Senna was obviously very much putting him on a pedestal, and this is certainly not what they do in this film at all.
No, this is very much warts and all, isn't it?
And as a result, I think it's far more interesting to those with little or no prior knowledge of Fischer, and it's helped, I think, because the production values in this are just so high. I mean, it's actually, I think, something that was just filmed for as an HBO television thing originally. But
yes,
this is substantially prettier than you'd probably expect from this kind of thing. Okay, you can't do much with documentary footage, but just the kind of talking head shots are sort of far more appealingly framed and shot than you'd often see in this kind of run-of-the-mill documentarian stuff. Yeah, likeable and interesting. I really enjoyed it.
And I'd point out too that when a knowledge of chess would actually be important, they do have a Hungarian chess champion talking to the camera and explaining fairly clearly and in an fairly easy to understand manner quite why what he did was so special or so different,
yeah,
which really helps actually, because there are points where the chess itself is significant.
Yeah.
And it's rather enlightening too, particularly in a world where what people are apparently interested in now is Nyan Cat, and I'm applying to leave the world as soon as possible, that in the middle of the 1970s, there really was a huge number of people, a huge number of people interested in a chess match. A chess match was headline news. It was in newspapers and on television for months. And it's really quite hard to comprehend that nowadays.
It's also good. I'd somehow managed to miss the whole sort of last few years of Fischer. I'm not altogether sure I'm happier knowing what he descended to at the end of his life, but it certainly makes for compelling watching.
In the way that crazy people often do, he's exactly as mental but interesting at the end as, for instance, you know, David Icke going on about lizard people.
Yeah.
Although not quite that crazy, fortunately. Next up, Scott's going to tell us about a sequel to a film he saw at the festival a couple of years ago now, Scott, isn't that right?
It was certainly very much ballyhoo, and I didn't quite get the extent of fuss about the first Elite Squad, but I liked it well enough, so the prospect of a sequel wasn't too unappealing to me. We go back to Brazil for the Elite Squad of Police/Commandos, and basically the entire point of the first film, that being the boss's quest to try and get someone to replace him, is immediately upturned as he just returns back to duty for mystery reason X. We kick off more or less with a botched hostage situation of sorts at a prison riot that his team were trying to sort out. It puts him on a collision course with a human rights advocate who also happens to have shacked up with his ex-wife and is now raising his child. This is given a quite a high importance early on. And it looks like it's going to become the main focus of the film, and then it's more or less kind of ignored for an awful lot of the rest of it. The bulk of the film is taken up with Colonel Nascimento's ascension to a higher level, a kind of homeland security style governmental role. And he's trying to track down on the drug dealers in the favelas and also the corruption endemic in the police squad. The basic idea is that if you get rid of the former, you should automatically get rid of the latter. But the cops are far more imaginative and resourceful and have better political connections than you'd counted on, and they transition from just accepting bribes to forming entire protection rackets. It's a little strange, I suppose. It's like someone watched the first film and thought, I know what's missing, bureaucracy, and started putting that on. That said, I can't think of too many major problems with the film. I did like it pretty much as well as I did the first one, which is more than you can say for a lot of sequels. Again, it's dynamic, stylish and punchy, just like the first one. The narrative, I think, takes a little bit too long to get rolling. There's a lot of pre-roll that doesn't end up leading anywhere. But once it starts picking up pace, it's very easy to go along with. I guess the only minor issue I've got with the film is that to call itself Elite Squad 2, it's had to jump through a couple of hoops and have the returning characters act, especially at the start, in ways that seem to be contrary to how I would remember them acting from the first film. And the whole point of bringing Nascimento back seems kind of silly and pointless, to the contrary to the entire point of the first film. I get the feeling that the opening half hour, which is where most of the problems lie, might have been more comfortable if it was a film that had no connection whatsoever to the first Elite Squad, and I don't think it would have hurt the overall quality of the film one jot. Overall though, it's a pretty good police procedural, and I think it is well worth a look.
Indeed, although I'm just wondering, this is saying that this film is perhaps symptomatic of quite what's wrong with the festival this year, because a sequel at all doesn't seem very festively.
True.
And although admittedly it also had its US premiere at the Los Angeles Film Festival around about the same time it was shown in Edinburgh, It did make in Brazil $62 million. You know, it's not a particularly small film.
No.
So anyway, that's a discussion to be carried on perhaps next year if things change.
So we crash on to Norway for Trollhunter?
Yes, so The Trollhunter is a pseudo-documentary which sets up its stall in a Cloverfield-like way using supposedly found footage taken by a team of young filmmakers from an Norwegian university. These documentarians track a mysterious hunter who they believe is illegally shooting bears, but they discover that he is in fact after much larger and much more dangerous prey. Now first of all, I suppose that the pseudo-documentary style looks fairly convincingly like that of a real documentary, but that's pretty old hat now, and it's a long time since it was anything to be particularly impressed by. However, the big problem I find with this film is that the trying to be true nature of the Trollhunter is severely undermined by some, quite spectacularly in some cases, shonky CGI, due clearly to the film's ambition massively outweighing its budget. And there are other suspension of disbelief breakers, like the fur of a dead bear looking every bit as convincingly like that of a real animal as Ewok fur did, and troll tails in a cabin which suggests the primary constituent of troll exteriors is nylon. He lives and learns. None of that, of course, would matter if the Trollhunter was fun, but alas, it isn't. There's just nothing to get excited about or interested in here. The student film crew are banal to the point of being non-entities. They're just not personalised or characterised at all. And the one potential prospect for interest, the Trollhunter himself, Hans, is just far too earnest, and the troll mythology not engaging enough. Now, I would say that if I were Norwegian, I can imagine I may well get a lot more out of this film, being far more likely to be familiar with the mythology and some of the real events and locations that the Trollhunter tries to tie to troll activity. But not being steeped in that mythology and not knowing, it's just a rather slow, uneventful mockumentary. And so I'm afraid, for me, in the end, it's neither fun enough nor authentic looking enough, occupying instead of rather uncomfortable middle ground, and I would say it isn't worth your time. But did you get anything more of it than I, Scott?
Not really. I can't bring myself to be too upset about it. I mean, it's fairly obvious even from the title that it's going to be a daft film about hunting trolls, and that's never going to be the sort of thing that I'm going to like. It's maybe a bit like what you were saying in the last podcast about Pirates of the Caribbean 4. I mean, I can't disagree with anything you've said there. Would I be mischaracterising what you said? Basically, you didn't really like Pirates of the Caribbean 4 because it's another Pirates of the Caribbean film doing exactly what you'd expect, and I just don't need to see another one of them.
Yes.
And that's pretty much my issue with this film. There's just nothing here that I've not seen before. And if it's the sort of thing you like, then I suppose you will like it. The effects works. I'd say it's good for the budget, but it's not actually good in real terms.
Yes, I think you might consider that Doctor Who might be considered good for the budget, but it doesn't say a lot.
Yeah, I kind of like when Hans the Trollhunter has been a bit more surly. I kind of appreciated that a bit more. Yeah, I mean, felt like it had a southern character to it.
There are bits when I'm almost sure that that character is going to crack a smile. And I'm thinking that would just, that would change the film completely if it didn't try to take itself, I say seriously, which is perhaps not the best way to put it, because it's about hunting trolls. But I think there's a real missed opportunity here. I think it could have been really quite a fun thing. And I said, I didn't not enjoy all of it. Certainly the last 20 minutes I thought was a bit more interesting when they're trying to discover quite why the trolls have changed their nature. But it towards 80 odd minutes before that, that just weren't quite interesting enough. Saying about Hans, yeah, he's quite gruff, he's quite interesting, but he just needs to crack a smile and it would have transformed the film, I think.
The only thing in there that really annoyed me was this text at the start of the film, which is very stridently declaring that it's real, it's authentic. It's a film about trolls, of course it's not fucking real. Do you think I'm an idiot or something? Why are you saying that? It's just set up to annoy you before it's even rolled the first frame of the film.
Again, that, had it been a slightly more, perhaps not a comedy, but at least it had a bit more humour in it, that, I would have liked that bit at the start. Slightly may have worked even. But the rest of it, it's just too earnest.
Yeah, I mean, it's certainly not interesting, and it would certainly be my second least favourite film of all the things that I've seen. Not necessarily because I think it's bad, but I just was kind of nonplussed by it. It's just, at very best, average and possibly slightly substandard. But I suppose if you're comparing it with the rest of the kind of nominal horror output that you've seen lately, yes, it's better than all of that, but then again, so is a solid kick in the bollocks. Take of that what you will. I mean, I certainly wouldn't recommend it to anyone apart from die-hard fans of Norwegian trolls. I'm sure there's someone out there that is, but not us.
Just so nobody with an interest in certain types of troll gets their hopes up, it isn't about the small ones with the ridiculously brightly coloured hair. Actually, had it been them, that may have actually made it funny, that one of the species of trolls actually looked like that, but so many missed opportunities, I feel. So from Norway, we travel to Canada, and Oliver Sherman, Scott.
The story of two veterans of an unspecified war. It's a somewhat time-agnostic film. Could really have happened any time, so not particularly important. You have Franklin, played by Donald Logue, and Chairman Garrett Dillahunt. Franklin's managed to deal with his wartime experience. He settles down, finds a wife, generally goes about living the Canadian dream. But Sherman's not doing so well. He was nearly fatally wounded, took a bullet through the head, but Franklin had dragged him to safety, and in the 7 or so years since his discharge from hospital, he's struggled to fit back into normal society. He seems haunted by it, and he's socially awkward, and always seems on the verge of going down some kind of dark path. He goes to stay with Franklin just to kind of catch up and maybe try and heal some wounds. However, his wife soon grows tired of his presence, what with his drinking problem and swearing in front of their young child. And the question always comes out, right, when is Franklin and Irene going to get tired of Sherman and actually boot him out of the house? And what is Sherman going to do about this? Because he's clearly not in the best mental place. It's by no means conventional. I don't know, I've not really seen too many films dealing with post-traumatic stress disorder, which is really the heart of this. And this has taken a very minimal approach. There's really very little sensationalism around the issue. I mean, it's never even mentioned in those terms, but it's based entirely on the two performances from Donald Logue and Garrett Dillahunt. They are both very convincing. They have a very real relationship, and the characters don't feel hackneyed. Sherman feels like he's just someone who's struggling to fit back in. He does feel like a real character. And Franklin himself is, you know, seems to be a good guy trying to help him, but he's like everyone else, he's got his limits with how much he can help someone who really needs more professional help than he'd be able to give. And the deterioration of this relationship provides some moments of genuine tension and drama with the very minimal dialogue and some great use of ocular acting. There's the occasional tendency for the script to put in rhymes that sound far more like they should have been in a poem rather than anything that these characters would really seem like they would say on a day-to-day basis. But I can forgive that. It's a powerful and pretty uncomfortable watch. It's not easy to love. It's very slowly paced. It doesn't feel like an awful lot happens, but it is the sort of slow burn that gives you the kind of punch in the end of the film where it kicks into a higher gear. There's none of the overwhelming scores or other attempts at tugging on heartstrings, which I applaud wholeheartedly, but it can make it seem a little bit Spartan. It's far from an easy film to watch, and it's also really not the kind of film that you would say that you can enjoy. It's not exactly a laugh riot, but it does have a good punch. It's an impact that few dramas I've watched this year have been able to match, and if it shows up near you, I think it's definitely worth the while of tracking it down and giving it a go.
And having missed it at the festival, I certainly do so.
Take a trip back in time to 1973 Santiago in Chile with Postmortem. Drew, would you care to fill us in on some of that film?
No. I really don't want to, but I will. Okay. Right, it's the final days of Chilean President Salvador Allende's administration. Civil unrest is mounting and a coup d'etat is brewing. Against this backdrop, a mortuary assistant falls in love with his neighbour, a dancer at a burlesque club whose family happen to be enemies of the people seeking to topple Allende. And some dull stuff happens.
Doesn't it just?
Oh my god, does the dull stuff happen. I'm really finding it difficult to find the will to mention any more about this film. Oh, crikey. Now, I really do hate to be reductive and dismissive. I don't like it. I don't like it on other people. I said I don't like it myself. But the older I get, the harder I find it to avoid doing so. I think because I've just seen too many bad films. So I'm going to be reductive and dismissive. This is pish. But if I really must elaborate... Actually, no, this is pish. I've seen people describe it as a tonal piece, which is fine, but the tone is apparently dull and grey, because that's all. Nothing happens. There is nothing to enjoy in this film, there's nothing to get your teeth into. The whole film is shot in an incredibly grey palette, perhaps just occasional brown. The drawing in of this mortuary assistant into the military coup is just seems artificial, unnecessary, unbelievable. The characters, the main character in particular, is the least interesting man on the planet, and I don't think I'm doing the character a disservice by saying that. The woman is unlikable. He's an idiot for liking her. Meh. It's just so bad. It's so dull. I'd also would like to point out, if anybody's read the quick plot synopsis in the front on this page on IMDb, it says the man falls in love with a burlesque dancer who mysteriously disappears. She doesn't mysteriously disappear. Not at all.
No.
She goes away for a day and comes back a bit later.
Yeah.
Not really mysterious disappearance, or indeed a disappearance at all, mysterious or otherwise.
I was wildly missold in this film, by the way. Bafflingly well received from the reviews that I've read and the plot synopsis I've seen. I must have watched a different film.
Yes, that's what I'm thinking,
pretty
because
sure
this is terrible.
There's one character in the whole film that's remotely sympathetic, or for that matter, believably human, and she gets shot. Everyone else, including the two normal leads, can just oscillate between being really creepy and really unlikable.
That's perhaps the one bit of character and characterization the main character has. He's really, really dumb. Cranky, he's creepy. What a weird look.
If that's what they were shooting for...
Spot on.
Congratulations, guys. You've nailed it. I wonder if there's something lost in the translation as well. The broad strokes of what I was trying to do seemed obvious, but I mean, I have no idea why anyone was doing what they were doing in most of these scenes.
I did wonder about that too. I think, again, it's perhaps if you were Chilean, you'd be more familiar with the events here, so perhaps have some more meaning for you. But
yeah,
when you're not Chilean and you're trying to sell it to an international audience, you've got to give some people some idea of quite what's happening, which they don't. But
yeah,
it's not like some film may be using that as a backdrop and it's to do with the struggle for survival or what people do in that sort of situation. Because nothing happens.
No. Hmm.
The guy's creepy. People are miserable. There's the really, really strange thing of there are two cars in the middle of the street apparently stomped on by Megatron, because there's nothing else to explain why these two cars look like they've been stood on by a giant robot. I can't describe it any other way. You know, but I mean, Scott, there's these two smoking cars, there's no damage anywhere else, but they look like they've been stood on, which is a really odd mystery. Perhaps General Pinochet, who's the guy in charge of the military coup, had a bit more military tech than anybody was previously aware of.
There's a conspiracy theory you don't hear very often.
No.
the American funded the junta, that's fine, but they also got Megatron in.
And it really does sound like we're being dismissive about this film. We're not really saying much about it, but there's not much to say. Nothing happens. The characters are unlikable. It's very, very dull. There have people been saying, some of the reviews I've read, that it's about the end of a type of life. Yeah, yeah. I mean, presumably they're smoking crack.
The end of a glorious life where creepy old men would perv on younger, annoying burlesque dancers. That most common of human tropes.
So, and my final words on the film would be, watcheth not Pablo Larraín's postmortem, for verily, 'tis boss.
And if you stare into it for too long, it will stare back at you. It does win the one prize that I was given out this festival for the longest single shot building a barricade scene, which I believe lasted for about 45 minutes.
That was a good one, wasn't it? So we'll move on from that terrible, terrible film, Scott, to a film that you might think we'd have more hope for, having last year in particular, and you in particular, having had a lot of success from films from Denmark.
Yeah, and this is another one from that hallowed land, which I turned out to enjoy as well, just to spoil the ending of the review there. The Truth About Men, or as it is pronounced in Denmarkish... Sandhagen Almindy? I don't know.
Flawless. Scott.
I think that's how it's pronounced.
Peter Schmeichel applauds you.
as he always does. I keep in a wardrobe just the occasional ego boost just comes out and applauds. So in this film we have Mads, who is a screenwriter, and he goes through his midlife crisis, perhaps a little bit earlier than expected. I can't remember the exact age, but I think he's like late 20s, early 30s. He decides he's got nothing in common with his long-term fiancé, and that his current employment, as he churns out generic scripts for a long-running cop drama, is a far cry from where he imagined himself being as a teenager, and he revolves to shake all this up. He breaks up with his fiancée, moves into a flat with the intention of writing his magnum opus, and resolves to find the love of his life, initially focusing on a rebellious childhood flame who he's never been able to forget. On tracking her down, he's disappointed to find that, predictably enough, she's now just a normal member of the public, not the unique and special snowflake that he'd been idolising for all these years. This general concept continues through this little journey of self-discovery as he struggles with his writing and so on and so forth. And it's beginning to sound a little bit like the setup to a rom-com, but I thought the film does a pretty good job of subverting that expectation and ploughing a course that's far more realistic. It sits very well with the intercuts of various thoughts that Mads had played out as though they're coming from one of his previous movies, which stays just the right side of postmodern self-referentialism to be charming rather than vastly annoying, which it could quite easily have been.
Yes, that is the fairly success of the film. That could have been a killer, quite frankly.
Yeah.
I keep seeing visions of cartoon characters.
I might not agree with the conclusions of the truth about men, but I did enjoy watching it reach them. Mads is believable and, for the most part, surprisingly likeable, given his frequent lurches into emo kid navel-gazing and self-destruction and so forth, and any of the other negative emotions, but it is the fact that he's so human, so flawed, that makes him more engaging than other would be if he's... Than other lead characters in the rom-com category, which I suppose is still the closest pigeonhole I can shove this in. I'm not altogether sure how much mainstream appeal the film will have. The way the lead character starts weaving movie narrative structures into his own life, coupled with playing off movie tropes, it means that it's going to require a pretty reasonable level of movie literacy to appreciate in the way that the creators intend. However, as the audience would probably dovetail quite nicely with anyone who would listen to a movie review podcast, I think I've very little hesitation in recommending The Truth About Men to anyone listening to my fantastic voice just now. I really quite enjoyed this. No massive complaints with it. It's pretty funny for the most part. Mads, while he's often a prick, he feels sort of human enough that he can kind of let him away with most of that. And yeah, for the most part, I enjoyed it. I have no bones to pick with it.
Well, I think here we're a bit back to the Pirates of the Caribbean again, but in reverse, in that I can't really disagree with pretty much anything you said there, Scott, but I didn't enjoy it quite as much as you. Which is not to say I didn't enjoy it. Don't have a good deal to add. The problem being, I think it perhaps comes down to something similar or connected to what you said about not necessarily agreeing with the conclusions of The Truth About Men.
Yeah.
The problem is that, and I guess Mads is reasonably likable and engaging, but he's a bit of a wanker.
Yep,
and
can't
just
fault
some
that.
Of the time I just wanted to slap him.
Yes, definitely felt that. Although, again, that's part of why I liked it, because it's very rare that I actually engage with a character enough to want to do anything like that, rather than just sort of watch it in a blank, apathetic stare, which is my general default state for everything.
Yes, as you may well know, people listening, I am essentially an angrier individual than Scott most of the time, so I find myself wanting to slap people quite often. I just found it harder to warm to the character, just because, well, as I say, he's a wanker, he needs a slap, and there's just things like, he starts off the film with a very beautiful woman who loves him and he seems to have a fairly comfortable life. Perhaps he wants to explore his boundaries a bit, but still, he's just acting like a bit of a spoiled brat at the beginning there. I won't do it later. It's certainly worth a watch if you can stomach the character, which you probably will do. The conclusions, I'm not quite sure, are particularly compelling, but it's interesting enough watch. There's some good bits of humour in it. It's nicely shot. Yeah, watch it. I probably said it was worth a watch about four times there.
Well,
there's quite a lot of her film I apparently didn't like all that much.
But still worth watching.
Yes, it's definitely worth a watch.
But the question on everyone's lips, or at least mine as I ask it, is can the same thing be said about Our Day Will Come or Notre Jour Viendra? Notre Jour Viendra, as I think they say in... this is Greek, is it? Is it Greek? No, it's French.
It's French. And it rather nicely fills in this year's completely fucking mental quota. this was the last film I watched on the festival, and I was worried that there wasn't going to be anything that would fit in there. This is the story of Patrick and Remy. It's a road movie of sorts, perhaps. Remy is a weird, bullied social misfit who runs away from home after a physical argument with his mother and sister. He's picked up by a guidance counsellor and psychoanalyst, Patrick, played by Vincent Cassell, as he's driving by. It's not quite clear why he does this. You might think that...
You're not kidding.
You might think that he's picked him up because he's Remy's guidance counsellor, but a line later on in the film suggests that, no, he's just a bloke that's driving by. This is significant, given what they get up to later on. Let me get back to Patrick. So, Patrick, a homophobe, racist, anti-Semite, probable paedophile, and general all-round bigoted sociopath, decides that he will help Fanny Boss, or Remy, to assert himself in the world. He does this because he's of the same persecuted minority as he, a people with no language, no army, no nation. Yes, as you've no doubt worked out by now, they're redheads. Yes, you heard me right. Redheads. They're the persecuted redhead minority.
And you don't know what it's like.
Are they angry? In his bizarre attempt to promote Remy in the wider world, he secures from a girl by the obvious expedient of presenting him to two random 18-year-olds as a Russian kickboxer. After which, Patrick's new protege begins to find utter confidence and assertiveness. After finding out, in a supermarket, naturally, of the existence of the mystical land of Ireland, of which he was apparently heretofore oblivious, he realises the island is the promised land of redheads. So he decides that he and his mentor must drive across France to Calais to catch a ferry there to the Emerald Isle. And I'm not joking about this supermarket thing, by the way, in a sort of, you know, Costco-like place. In the middle of it, for some reason, is a display of large cardboard cutouts of red-headed Irish people on big signs saying Ireland and a pamphlet with fairy things. This is fucking mental. So, anyway, yes, it's nice he must travel to Calais, and soon after starting the journey, he comes to the realisation he must be the Ginger Messiah. And also before travelling to Ireland to messiah them, he must procure some smart new clothes and a crossbow. And unfortunately, I find myself laughing at this quite a lot as I read out my notes here, because it sounds so mental. Unfortunately, it's also really, really dull. Really, really bad. I think this has been sort of portrayed as some sort of madcap road movie. But the two characters are so out to lunch, unlikable, hideous, and not because of their red hair, that it's not a film you can enjoy watching in any ways whatsoever. It's mad. Mad as a badger. Mad as a badger with rabies. As these two bizarre friends, if such a word's appropriate here, leave a trail of destruction behind them across France, and... Oh, jings. Scott, take up the baton, please.
I am at a total loss to describe this film. I think round about the time where Patrick starts picking a fight, apparently in a bid to cheer Remy up with a group of Arabs, I completely lost touch with what anyone was doing and any reason why they had for doing anything that they were doing. I don't know, it's something like This Is England, but with redheads rather than skinheads.
Yeah, well, that's the thing. There's no impulsion on any film to necessarily have likable characters. And you have something like, well, Vincent Cassell, while being... He's quite incredibly unlikable in this film. But not long before, we saw him in The Rather Good Marine, where he played a sociopath, a murderer, a gangster. But it was compelling in that film, and it was an interesting film because the character was interesting, and it was a criminal, and it made sense to make a film about that. So there's no compulsion why the character has to be likable, and This Is England was one thing I was thinking of as well. But that's telling the story of a corrupted youth and a real movement in a country, a real political movement. But this is just... an imagined minority, imagined persecution, mental, unlikable sociopaths making people's life a misery in a car.
I'll give it one thing, right? I have no idea what to compare this film against.
Well, right. So it's unique.
Which, is that one thing? It is unique. You've got to give it that. Unfortunately, it's unique because I have no explanation whatsoever regarding how the characters were introduced to at the start of the film end up doing the things that are doing at the end of the film without invoking, like, spiking LSD into the water supply or something. I mean, if you watch the first 50 minutes of this film, and then the last 50 minutes of this film, you would think they were from completely different films. There's just no through line that you could possibly imagine that would have these characters doing this stuff at the end. And it doesn't look like the scriptwriters could come up with any conceivable reason for it either.
And also, there's significant problems with the casting as well, because, well, Vincent Cassell is just spectacularly unlikable. I guess that's maybe more character than the casting thing. But the guy playing Remy is every bit as charismatic and interesting as Jay from, what was it called, that Australian film, was Animal Kingdom?
Animal Kingdom, yeah.
That we reviewed a few podcasts ago. There's nothing to like or get your teeth into in this film at all. And as Scott says, there's no through line. None of it makes any sense.
I think there's a certain amount of enjoyment to add from watching Vincent Cassell just sort of run around gurning and frothing at the mouth. But that's really it. The point of any of this film completely eludes me. I suppose it's basically the same kind of comments I got about Postmortem. I thought this is actually a little bit more entertaining, if just because of the sheer batshit mentalness of it all. I think the closest comparison I've got is Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas, because I don't really understand why anything was going on in that film either. But at least they had the proper excuse of mind-altering drugs. This doesn't. It's just baffling. I would like to point out that these in no way speak for the general populace of redheads, who are generally sensitive, intelligent, handsome, modest, just generally all-round wonderful people.
Indeed. So let's move swiftly on from this to a film that I believe is considerably more worthy of your attention. Scott, Tomboy.
In Tomboy, a family moved to a new town. One of the sisters of the mother and father, Laurie, takes an unusual approach to making new friends when she arrives at the new location, on seemingly little more than a whim. When she's approached by a fellow kid in the neighbourhood, Lisa, she gives her name as Michael, and then pretends to be a boy. Laurie has more or less the physical characteristics to get away with this pretense, but it's only going to be a matter of time before this gig is up, particularly when a new school term starts in a few weeks. But until that day occurs, she enjoys her little game, although the difference between what would actually happen in this film had she admitted to being a girl at the outset, and what she'd be doing if she was a boy, seems to be essentially nothing. They do the usual things that the kids have. They'll kick around and play football. It's set in summer, obviously, so there's no school hasn't started yet. So they punt a ball around, they'll hang out, they'll play silly games, they will go swimming in a lake, which necessitates the construction of a plasticine penis, which is one of the strangest scenes in the film, I think.
Well, that's certainly the story of all my summer holidays.
There's not an awful lot that's happening in the film. The main point of conflict, I suppose, comes up when Lisa starts to show an attraction for Laurie slash Michael, as she astutely observes that she's not like other boys. But this is all pretty innocent, given that we're talking about 10-year-old kids or something like that. There's nothing particularly controversial going on. It's not a Larry Clark film. I'm underselling this film somewhat, but there isn't an awful lot narratively to tell you about it. It's more about mood. What it does do very well is paint a nice little family portrait of this family. The sister's been with her father and things like that. How she seems to be playing a more boyish role. Just found it really quite interesting. It's basically hinged on a tremendous performance from the young Zoe Heeran. It's very compelling. It doesn't feel like you're watching something that's scripted for an awful lot of the time, which is something of an achievement. If I have a problem with it, I'm not really sure what it's trying to say, if indeed it is trying to make any overarching point about the relationships and dynamics between families and generational relationships or anything like that, or any gendered relationships. It seems to kind of hint at things like that without ever actually saying anything. Mm-hmm. Which is maybe slightly disappointing if you were, for some reason, looking for that. But if you just want to watch it as a charming tale with some engaging central characters and a tremendous portrayal of a family that for once isn't, fractured and, full of drama because of almost arbitrary conflict. The amount of sort of family dramas you've seen that are based around fights, essentially, I mean, that's relatively easy to write drama-wise because you've got a conflict there, and when you don't really have any conflict at all, it makes it far more interesting to build a compelling film, which this has done, and for that reason I very much enjoyed it. It's beautifully shot, sympathetically told, and outstandingly performed, so yes, very well worth a watch. Jack Goes Boating. Fill us in, boy.
Indeed. Well, this is the first time behind the camera for Philip Seymour Hoffman, who also stars. Jack Goes Boating is the tale of Jack. Jack is a limo driver. Jack is set up with a woman by his best friend, Clyde. Jack must then get over his various personal problems and, apparently, learn to swim in order to succeed with this woman, who is also riddled with problems. Jack's friend, Clyde and Lucy, also have problems. I am Jack's wasted 90 minutes. It's a relationship drama. There's not a great deal of plot to go into. Philip Seymour Hoffman hasn't had a lot of luck in love. Meets Lucy, played by Amy Ryan. She's had troubles of her own, as I mentioned, and they just got to try and work them out. His friends have problems. They've got to try and work them out, or not. It's a relationship drama. Relationships quite often dull. And I have to say this, the dialogue is authentic, and Philip Seymour Hoffman and Amy Ryan are both excellent. Give really believable, authentic performances. Yeah, everything about this film feels real. It feels believable. Unfortunately, that's exactly the problem. The characters are miserable. The story is miserable. And for me, as good as the acting may be, Jack Ghost Posting simply isn't enjoyable. I believe every word of what they're saying. I believe this could happen to anybody in the world, but I just don't understand why anybody would want to see it happen. There, I've said my piece. Your retort, sir?
They're certainly stylishly shot scenes. The acting's more or less impeccable. The characters and the relationships do, as you say, feel real and believable. I'm more or less parroting what you're saying here. But there are so many elements in here that I genuinely like that I'm kind of puzzled as to why I didn't enjoy it at all. It seems like the math doesn't add up. The end result is very much less than the sum of its parts.
Exactly what I was going to say, yes. Very much less than the sum of its parts. It's surprising. Philip Seymour Hoffman generally is enough for me to give a film a pass because he's generally incredibly watchable. Oh, and then he is in here. But you can't fault them. They're impeccable, but it's just not interesting.
It's not saying anything about anything. Its only real point seems to be that relationships can be hard. Thank you, Captain Obvious. There's really nothing in here that I could say you need to watch it because of this fantastic element or this combination of elements that I really enjoyed. No, there's just nothing in here that's new, nothing in here that's interesting, just bland. And left me a little bored. It's nothing like as offensive as either Postmortem or Nos Tresor Vendra, but it's just nothing in here to get your teeth into. I can't give you any reason to go and see it. It's not a bad film in any stretch of the imagination. It's just something that really doesn't seem to have any particular point or uniqueness to warrant its existence in a world where there's no shortage of other better films out there.
Indeed. I'm afraid even the quality acting really isn't a good enough reason to watch it.
No.
That's just likely to make you quite unhappy at the end, because nobody in the film's happy. We move from the USA, though, to Spain, and perhaps we'll have had more luck with The Last Circus. But since it has clowns, wouldn't get your hopes up. Scott.
The Last Circus, or Balada Trieste de Trompeta, which I think is Ballad of the Sad Trumpet.
So it's not an obvious translation into The Last Circus. So.
You have to have some kind of respect for a film which more or less starts with a clown in a dress wielding a machete leading a charge against forces in the Spanish Civil War.
Okay, before you go on, Scott, I'm just going to say that I do agree you have to respect that. That amused the hell out of me. But there are two things that I simply cannot respect. Number one, this film starts off with clowns entertaining children. The children are entertained and laughed. That would not happen. If it were funny, clowns wouldn't be doing it. And number two, an army comes in and sees the clowns and doesn't kill them on sight. That lost me in the first minute.
I know you wish it was otherwise, but there is no standing orders for armies to immediately kill all clowns. Right? You've got to get this sick fantasy away from you.
Clowns will be first against the wall when the revolution comes.
So in the charge leading clown with the machete is captured by the forces of darkness and taken away to a prison camp. This upsets his son, but nonetheless he decides to grow up and become a clown as well, following on from a long family line of clowning, I guess. Didn't know it was hereditary. What happens next is I'm not entirely sure. He tries to take revenge against the system of the evil dictator
Franco.
M. Bison. I've decided M. Bison's more fitting with the general tone of this film. Basically, it skips to mid-70s Spain, where he is grown up, tries to be a clown, joins a new circus, where he's playing second fiddle to an equally psychotic clown, Sergio, who is proper mental. His given reason for becoming a clown was so he doesn't kill anyone.
Yeah, he's basically Begbie the clown.
Begbie the clown.
Not far off of it anyway.
Yeah, so he joins up with Begbie. I don't think he was his name. Javier's the kid. He grows up to join the circus. He falls in love with Sergio's wife, or his girlfriend, can't remember his wife or girlfriend now, Natalia, the acrobat, played by Carolina Bang, and then all sorts of horrible, horrible things occur, and I'm not quite sure exactly why they occurred. Sergio and Javier eventually come to blows, which prompts an all-out circus of mentalness. And to be honest, after about an hour, this film just goes completely mental, and I don't really understand. There's no way I can possibly put it up into any kind of nice bullet point list here. It just goes entirely off the rails as winds up with him running naked through the woods, falling into a pit, and then having a stag fall on him. At which point I just kind of stopped trying to make sense of anything, and by the time he's making himself up to look like a cross between a clown and a pope running around wielding two AK-47s, I just don't know what to deal with any of this. It's a very, 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 very strange film. I can't really say whether I liked it or disliked it. It's the kind of film where you conventional terms like that don't seem to apply. It's mental.
Yes, I think there's that is that to extend, but I can comfortably say I did not enjoy it. The problem being that this film doesn't really know what it is. It's a mixture of four, perhaps five genres. While it settles on mental, batshit mental, at the end, the first half suffers from constant tonal shifts that just do not sit well together at all. One minute it's like a slash about a film, one minute it's about domestic abuse, the next it's a farce, and then it's a comedy. It's a farce, it's domestic abuse, and it's just terrible. They just don't sit well together, and then it just goes completely off the rails in the second half, and I have no idea what I'm meant to be taking seriously and what I'm not, what's happening in people's mind. It's really badly cut because things seem to happen that should take weeks have happened the next morning. Apparently there's strange things going on with motorbikes and hideouts in caves. Oh, it's crazy. You certainly do not want to watch it. It would not be a good use of your time.
I would say it's almost worth getting a hold of it for the first half hour. I did genuinely enjoy the first half hour. But as soon as it stops being about his father and the young Javier and goes on to be the new one, you might as well just stop. Because at that point, it just becomes too aggressively strange and tonal shifty for to be of anything. But the first half hour, I really genuinely enjoyed. And that gave it a bit of leeway for me to kind of give it a pass for the next half hour or so. But by the time last half hour goes, it was just kind of waiting for it to end. At least it's inventive.
There's certainly some amusement to be had. Probably the first half hour, as you say, Scott. But it's suffering from these constant tonal shifts there of just not knowing what it wants to be.
Yeah.
And then the rest of it, again, if describing it, it might sound amusing, but when you see it on screen, it's just not. You've got Javier, who, after a calamitous event, turns feral, eats a raw stag, gets captured by a member of Franco's army, becomes a gun dog, has a pitch in his mouth, bites Franco, and sticks an arrow in his face.
As you do.
As you do. Cuckoo.
At least wins some points for being relatively unique and properly mental, but it falls into the same category as Our Day Will Come. It's mental for the sake of being mental, and it's not all that enjoyable by the time you get to the end of it. You can see almost how it could have worked. There's points where you can kind of see what they're aiming for, but it's like trying very desperately to go, look at me, I'm a cult classic from the outset, and you can't do that. You've got that badge is awarded to people. It's not designed in from the outset. It's trying a bit too much to go over the edge and be a bit, you know, well, look at me, aren't I quirky? And doesn't quite make it, I'm afraid.
Indeed not.
That'll do for that then. We'll round things off with a slightly more wholesome film, The Borrower Arity, from Studio Ghibli. Drew?
If you're rather stolen the first line of what I was going to say there, Scott, perhaps all you need to know about this film would be two words. That is Studio Ghibli. This indeed being the latest film from that perennial one-liner favourite, Kagurashi no Arrietty, directed by Hiromasa Yonabayashi, from a screenplay by Hayao Miyazaki based on Mary Norton's classic novel The Borrowers. If you're not familiar with that novel, the idea being a race of perhaps 2-inch-high humanoid creatures called borrowers who live alongside humans and get all their resources by borrowing. Apparently this is distinct from stealing things from humans that they won't otherwise miss. But given that this comes down to a sugar cube, which will last the family for 6 months, and the occasional tissue, which could last for a year, I think they're probably going to be all right. This story is of a young borrower called Arietti, whose family fear they may be the only borrowers left alive, who is seen one day by a young boy called Sho, who's moved into the house where Arietti lives, to recover from an illness.
Any sort of attempt at a plot summary of this film ties in with my basic problem that any adaptation of The Borrowers that I've seen, which admittedly isn't all of them and I've not read the source material, but they all seem to come back to the same point of going, look, little people. And the whole point of this film is that there are little people and there's nothing else to the film at all. Because it's Studio Ghibli, there's a lot of things that you can almost check off as being taken for granted. There's a lot of really nice touches. It is astonishingly pretty. It's beautifully animated. Everything on a technical level is fabulous. But the basic story is there are a number of little people living in a house. Boy sees them and goes, oh look, there's a little person. There's a very slight attempt at building a relationship between the littlest kid, borrower Arity, and Sho, until the needlessly evil housekeeper for some reason gets wind of it and tries to exterminate them by calling out a pest control service, and Sho stops that happening and helps the borrower's family escape to safety. And that's it. It doesn't really seem to have anything in particular to say about any of this. none of the relationships that are formed in this film seem to have any kind of real point. I mean, it's all nicely done. There's a nice kind of relationship between the Borrower family itself and them thinking they're the last people there and so on and so forth. There's lots of like little nice touches all the way throughout it, but none of it seems to add up into actually saying anything. It's still not a bad film to watch, and it's very nice, and I'm sure kids would get a kick out of it, but where a lot of the other Studio Ghibli films have a lot of depth and a lot of emotion and seem to say a lot more than just simply having a nice little tale, this is just a nice little tale. It's one of the weaker Ghibli films, as most of the ones that are based on someone else's source material are, like things like Howl's Moving Castle. You know, it's a perfectly fine film, but it's just fine. It's not in the same league as Princess Mononoke or Spirited Away, any of the other ones, Totoro, anything like that. But I don't want to sound too down about this film. I was a little disappointed with it because it's not mind-blowingly fantastic like I expect all Studio Ghibli films to be, but it's still substantially better than anything else you'd put in front of kids, for the most part.
There's something I was thinking too, something I've always appreciated with Studio Ghibli films too, is that it's something we all three of us, the one line I really appreciate about Coraline as well, is that there's peacefulness in it. It's not all Western animations of all manic stuff going on all the time. You're allowed to be quiet, not have a lot happen, and be contemplative for a while, which is nice. And it's a tremendously beautiful film and has quite a pleasant score as well, although I could quite happily ditch the rather crappy 1980s style theme song.
Dear Lord, yes.
But I think what you say, I would mostly agree with Scott. I perhaps got more of it just because I just like looking at it. I was quite happy just to see the pretty pictures. Yeah. It doesn't have a lot to say. It's near the Borrowers doesn't seem to be a strong story. And there's yet another adaptation of the Borrowers coming out at the end of this year, I believe.
Look, I'll put my hands up. Maybe I'm wrong about this.
It seems to be perennially adapted because, I don't know, little people because of little people. Little people. Little people, they're little.
Everyone seems to like it.
Themes from Studio Ghibli stuff about being environmentally aware, that sort of thing, is far more heavily handed in this.
Yeah, it's shoehorned in quite obviously, isn't
heavily.
It?
Basically, there's a big clunking great scene where it goes, there aren't many of us borrowers. Ah, there are 6 billion humans. You'll all be dying out. Aren't humans bad because everything's dying out? It's kind of artless compared to a lot of their previous work.
It does seem a lot more heavy-handed in the way it's shoehorning ecological themes into there. It was kind of charmless. And that's something that happened somewhat in Ponyo as well, the last Ghibli film. I hope it's not a recurring theme of them just trying to bolt an ecological message onto things that no way needed to have it bolted onto. Sure, you could have done this in a bit more artful way. But again, I don't want to end this sounding like I was massively upset with Arrietty. Yes, I think it's one of the minor Studio Ghibli works, but it's still pretty good. It's still one of the better films that you could expose your children to. I did enjoy it for the most part. I just don't think the source material is as worthy as a lot of the other Ghibli films deserves. But as you say, it's been adapted umpteen times, so I'll hold my hands up. Maybe I'm wrong about this and, you know, everyone loves the story of, ooh, look, little people, but I didn't seem to get an awful lot more out of it than that. But yes, the fact that it is astonishingly pretty, beautifully animated and has so many nice touches is probably enough to make it worth recommending. It is worth watching, but it is not the best Ghibli film that I've seen. So that's your lot for 1 year. You should perhaps see most of these films appearing in cinemas or on DVD somewhere near you, and take that for what you will. Most of them, I thought, were pretty good. I think overall, I enjoyed more of the films that I saw this year, but I think that's perhaps because of being a bit more discerning. I wasn't, say, going to see things that I thought would be dreadful just to see how dreadful they were. Like, for example, Quality Control, which apparently was a 60-minute documentary of just following someone doing a shift at a laundry, which, you know, that didn't appeal to me for some reason. I don't know why that would seem to be a particularly cinematic endeavour.
That particularly stood out to me, and I thought, you know what, I just can't bear the excitement.
Yes,
I thought my head would probably explode.
Yes, it's not recommended for people with heart conditions.
Or eyes.
So that was this year. Not the most singularly exciting year of EIFF, although there was a decent amount of pretty decent films in there, but nothing massively exciting or new. Will it survive next year? Will we bother doing it next year? Well, there's a question. We'll see. We'll answer that about this time next year. It would be a shame to see this festival go away. It's been so iconic for the British film industry that letting it go to the dogs, it would be a disgrace.
I mean, it is the longest continually running film festival in the world. You think that would count for something?
Time and about 365 days of time specifically will tell. We may be doing this next year, and if not, we will be back soon enough with one of our regularly scheduled podcasts. If you have any comments, questions, insults, invective, the address for that, podcast@theoneliner.com. I have been Scott Morris, and Drew Tavendale has been Drew Tavendale.
Goodbye.
And we shall see you soon enough with one of our regular podcasts. Take care, guys. See you on the flip side. dog, so on and so forth. By the way, enjoy this theme music. I worked very hard to make this and only get to use it like once this year. So, you know, come on. Big up that.